Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of the Wolf Podcast. Today, we are joined by Amit. Amit, how are you?
What's up, man? Happy to be here.
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate you hopping on. Full transparency, I remember I came across, I'm a newbie on the whole FinTwit scene. I started a year ago, but I remember I came across your profile a couple years ago. You were the Palantir guy. So I'm sure we'll get into the Palantir down the line. But before we do, I want to you seem like around my age, maybe even younger, because I'm 30 years old. You look like you're in your mid-20s. So what got you into stocks? And tell us your background and how you became essentially the face of Palantir on FinTwitter. What made you want to talk about stocks? In a environment or in time when people your age, back in early 20s, when you're in your early 20s, nobody does that at your age. They're all behind the screens just watching everyone else do it. So what made you make that leap?
Yeah, so I'm 26. I'll be 27 in October. And I think it's a good question because one of the reasons I joined FinTwit was because I had no friends to talk about stocks with. Everyone wanted to talk about random stuff. I think that's the reason all of us are on FinTwit, mm-hmm. trying to get that community. I started watching stock videos on YouTube back in 2020 or 2019. And I was interested. I bought my first stock in 2019, didn't think much of it. And for some reason, I don't know, by end of 2021, I got interested in Palantir, learned a little bit about the company, threw some money in it, and I just started sharing my thoughts and opinions about the company. It was very elementary due diligence. I wouldn't even say it's sophisticated at all. It was just hey, this is a really interesting company. I'm getting kind of excited about that. And when I posted those initial videos and tweets, a lot of people were hey, we're also interested. We don't know what the hell this company does, but if you have some ideas, we're willing to hear you out because we also have some ideas. So none of us knew, but it was this mystery. And it almost was a Sherlock Holmes type of we have to solve the mystery of what is this company while at the same time the company is dropping in valuation every single day, yeah. Every company in 2022. And so that started the journey. Then I just got addicted to it. I got addicted to building content. From a content creation perspective, I've been in content for 10, 15 years. I remember having an unboxing channel on YouTube back in 2009. I always loved content, never really found my niche. Stocks was a niche I was interested in. Content I started getting a little bit better at in terms of talking to the camera, tweeting. And a couple years later, it's what I'm trying to do full time now.
So do you ever have, first off, congrats on the big sharks you've landed. You met Alex Karp, first off, the goats of all tech. You met him in person. I saw the photo. He was playing with your hair. That's a bucket list item for me. Do you ever have those self-reflection moments of damn, I just started this a couple years ago. And now I'm interviewing Robinhood CEO Vlad, or Karp is touching my hair and it's so casual. Do you ever have those moments? Because in my opinion, you made it. So appreciating the arc of your journey in this such a quick time, such a young age, I'm I'd be looking myself in the mirror every morning. You're the fucking stud.
I think things have moved really fast. So in February, for those that don't know, I got the privilege of interviewing the Robinhood CEO, and that came because I just started sharing my due diligence on the company when the stock was around $7-$8. And apparently Vlad reads Twitter, and their team reached out to me while I was doing a morning open stream, because I streamed the market open every single day. And their team DMs me while I'm on the market open. And I'm like, yeah, guys, the S&P 500, and the on my iPad, their Robinhood Communications pops up in the DMs. And the S&P 500. The S&P 500, and I'm reading this thing of hey, do you want to interview our CEO? And I'm like, guys, I just got a really weird DM. I'm going to need a second. And so that happens. And then a day before the interview, they invite me to their gold event in New York. I've never been invited to a special company event. And I'm like, yes, of course I'll go because I'm in New Jersey. So I was local. Went to the event, got to meet all their product engineers and employees from the startup days that were there. And that was an experience. Then we do the podcast. And, I did the podcast. A week later, they send me the footage. And you're kind of looking at this footage and you're like, when I post this, everything's changing. When I post this is not just a guy who's talking about stocks anymore. This is a guy that kind of was able to do something special in, at least in this universe. My sister doesn't know who the hell Vlad is. She doesn't care. But a lot of people on Twitter that actually care about the stock market care. And so I posted it. The interview does well. And then from there, it's been a really fast couple months in terms of other things happening. In terms of the answer to your question, yes, I've taken some moments to self-reflect on the journey. But the one thing I always warn myself against is that this game, and you're in this game, so you know this as well, is ruthless when it comes to media. Mm-hmm. You're here one day, you're gone the next. You take a couple of days off, you don't post for a few days. You quite literally become irrelevant because there is no barrier to entry when it comes to content creation. Anyone can start up an account, anyone can post. So, you call me the face of Palantir. I've been having to defend that face for the past couple of years because there's like 17,000 new accounts every day that are tweeting about Palantir because they want to be the face of Palantir. And so it's a competitive, ruthless environment, stocks, Palantir, anything you want to talk about. And so, yes, it has been an amazing journey, but I do know there's a lot of room to go and it's hard to look up because you take a couple of days off, you're done. And this game is a really privileged game. If you get to win in this game, you get to make content for a living. But you got to put in years of work to get there.
Dude, I completely relate. Like, I go on vacation with my fiance all the time, and she gets annoyed with me. I still work for an hour a morning of just like posting content, doing some due diligence. It's a grind. Like, you can't take a couple of days off because it's weird. You lose your edge somehow in those couple of days. Doesn't matter how many years you're doing it. It just feels like you're losing an edge. Maybe it's just you and I's personality of like, we can't ever turn it off. And if you feel like we're turning off, like it's game over, that could be it. But it's a brutal, brutal...
Even on the weekends, I can't turn it off. I'm like, I have to post. I have to create. 100%. And, you know?
And also...
It's the price of being in this game.
You've got some fanship, though, over the time. Like, I remember seeing other people, like, they watch your videos on their actual TV. I'm like,
yeah,
that's the new NBC. That's the new CNN now. Like, they go to Amit.
But yeah, that's been the craziest part. The morning open, we're getting, you know, close to 1,500-1,600 people every morning, and I'm just so grateful people choose to turn me on versus something else. And so I wake up 2 hours early and like I start reading, I start preparing new. You can't just get up and start talking, you know? Like, this is a really privileged position to be in if people trust you with information. So you have to remain objective, right? You can't just impose your beliefs because there are people that are listening to you for the news, they care. And so I take it very seriously. And then I try to make sure it's funny. You know, I pride myself on actually giving entertainment in the morning. So there'll be some raunchy jokes in there. But the point is people should leave thinking, oh, I want to come back the next day. You know,
will there be a podcast being launched?
For me, you know, the funny thing is I think of the market open and market close as like my own version of a podcast. A lot of people listen to it already. I do YouTube videos. I go live streams like every single day. So those are, I guess, podcasts. But yeah, pretty much.
So let's get into, again, Palantir. I was just like you, one of the first shareholders of Palantir under $10. Now it's becoming more mainstream, obviously, because their thesis is getting validated every quarter they go on.
Yep.
Tell me about the environment back then, like when you were initially adding in like the six and eights. Like, was it just as polarizing as it is right now, where people still don't believe Palantir is a real company? They think government consultant black box and everything they're saying is just being misled by a mass retail audience, and they're just pushing this narrative that's not true. I feel like it's the stock has tripled, but the polarizing nature of Palantir is still the same, and the narrative isn't really adjusting throughout the years, which is catching me off guard a bit.
Yeah, it is still polarizing. I think a lot of people think of Palantir as like a FinTwit darling, and while it is to a certain subset of FinTwit, the majority of people do not like this company. They think it's an evil spy company. They think it's trying to steal your data, and they think of the company as overvalued SaaS. I mean, like, there's like a ton of bear cases that are reasonable to throw at it. And then there's a ton of like sort of ideological dogmatic bear cases to throw at it. At $6, what was interesting, and this is where this goes back to the first couple of questions about content creation. There were very few people along with me that were quite honestly just continuing to post about the company. It's really easy when it was at $30 to say all the things you want about Palantir. When it's at $6, and you know, you're getting like pseudo death threats in your comments about this stock, do you still post? And for me, the reason I kept making a video every day, I wasn't making money off of it. It's not like YouTube was paying astronomical amounts of money for a couple thousand people, if that, that watched the video when the stock is down 90%. The reason I made videos about it was because I was genuinely fascinated by the company. And every day, or let's call it every month, they're putting out a couple new press releases. And I'm reading these press releases and I'm like, huh, this partnership makes sense. That partnership's a big deal. They're trying to do some really cool stuff there. And so in my head, I'm like, the stock doesn't reflect the reality of what I'm looking at, but I'm going to keep talking about it and maybe that reality changes. And then the fun thing is when you're one of the only people on the internet that's continually putting out content when the thing's in the gutter, if you're lucky enough for the thing to not be in the gutter anymore. And this is the nature of, you know, Dan Ives, Kathy Wood, Ross Gerber, they all took a bet on stocks when they were beat up like a Tesla in 2016 and they wrote it to the top, and that's how they built their brand. I think in FinTwit, all of us are trying to find undervalued companies. I know you posted one today about Jima or something that like popped this morning because—
Oh, Jumia. Yeah,
Jumia. Yeah, you were talking about it when it was cheap and now it's up, and it's like, that's where you get credibility and people care about you. The process from 6 to 27 at one point was a fun process this year because you know, people got to see the evolution of the company and the stock price reflect that. So it's still polarizing, but it's just as fun creating content about it as it was when it was $6.
So I get this question all the time because, again, I was overweight in the position below 10. They want to know what Palantir is. Like, they believe in like the thesis that we communicate to them, but they want to know like a 2-sentence, 10,000-foot view of like, what do they actually do? I have a difficult time just putting it in 2 sentences. Like I have to talk about for like 5 minutes because it's not as simple as just like Microsoft, for example. Like they're the backbone of enterprises worldwide. Like that's an easy explanation of Microsoft. What's your elevator pitch of what Palantir actually is as a company?
Yeah, I think it's kind of simple. I think an organization has data. Palantir manages that data using AI to be able to make the organization more effective and streamline productivity. So the way I think about it is every organization on the planet, whether it's a government or a commercial entity, has tons of data. That data is unstructured. What you need is a structured, essentially a structured symbolic representation of that data that can derive the business intelligence. And I just got to interview Palantir CTO Sham Shankar at an AI conference. And he said the one thing people misunderstand about Palantir is that they are trying to sell you a solution for a problem, not a solution that needs to be sold. And what he means by that is when they worked with Airbus, they've had an Airbus partnership for the past 10 years. That partnership connected all the vendors, distributors, and airline manufacturers together in a central operating system, what they call their ontology, that's their Foundry product, to connect all the disparate sources of data, and there's millions of those sources of data, into one place so that every organization, whether it's the United Airlines of the world or whether it's the subcontractors of one of the vendors of Deltas of the world, could come use that operating system together and become more efficient. You could imagine that same thing in hospitals. You could imagine that for energy companies. They have a big partnership with BP. So in a nutshell, I think of the company as, hey, they give you software for the data that you need to organize so that you can increase your revenue and your operating margins and decrease your costs. And to structure that data, you need something like a Palantir. And then they introduced an AIP product, which is their AI platform, to build on top of their ontology product to use LLMs to make that data even more meaningful. So I think they just make data make sense for companies. And I think that's going to be worth potentially trillions one day.
Well, you just brought up the AIP program. So AIP was clearly the inflection point that I was waiting on for Palantir. Like, that validated my thesis. I think they're on their way of being not eating Microsoft's launch on the operating system, but like it could be a dark horse candidate in like 5 to 7 years. Who knows?
Yeah.
You saw a ton of momentum Q4 of last year in their earnings prints. And you saw some follow through again on commercial clientele on Q1, but we didn't see the trickle on the top line as much as I anticipated, with back-to-back quarters of explosion on the customer front on the client side. So why do you think that is? I have a theory that I do think it might be a pricing issue where it is a large sum of cash to kind of be a client, and that's totally validated. But like it goes, I've worked in corporate strategy for 10 years. It goes through so many sign-offs for something that large of an expense. Yeah. And I think that's holding it off a bit. Like it's going to happen. It's just the can's getting kicked down the road of like, I see you, I hear you, I need more time to like sign off, do my due diligence. And you need like 5 or 6 other people to sign off similar fashion to finally push it through. What's your take on why there's like not much of a correlation as much as I thought on clients to top line revenue?
Yeah. And I think that's one of the good bear cases around Palantir, which is that they're a SaaS company trading at a relatively high premium, even after it fell 20% after earnings. And they're only growing 21% year over year. Most SaaS companies should be north of 30%. I think that's a fair criticism. I think the one metric to be concerned about is customer count, because as you said, customer count is going higher. U.S. commercial customer count, their fastest growing part of the business, is up 69% year over year, but the revenue is not necessarily reflecting that. I agree with you. I think the types of platforms they're selling, and they're trying to get more into SMBs, but that's probably not going to be a big part of the business for like another year or two. They're trying to sell a really thick product. And that thick product, to get the C-suites, multiple of them, to sign off on that, to literally become the operating system of your enterprise, we're talking about tens of hundreds of millions of dollars for many, many years. It's not that easy to sign up. What I like is that their customer count is increasing quarter over quarter. I think last quarter was like 11 or 12% from the previous quarter. And I think they added like 57 new customers, which is great. And those 57 customers, I believe, probably have paid, but they paid like a pilot fee to get into what they need to do. And then over the coming months or in years, that's going to be extended to be even further. Some of the data points I'm looking at are they getting existing customers to upgrade to AIP, which is the flagship software you talked about? And they just announced a partnership with Ringier, which is a German or a Swiss media company that they partnered with in 2018 that just signed a 5-year extension. And so when I'm looking at stuff like that, I'm like, okay, I think the revenue growth is definitely coming. The analysts definitely think it's coming as well. Every analyst upgraded them after these recent earnings. Mm-hmm. Even one of the biggest bears upgraded them from $5 to $9, even though the stock fell 20%. Tyler Radke from Citi, this guy's very interesting. He's hated Palantir for years. He says, oh yeah, the stock's worth 25, upgrade from 23. And before 23, it was like 20. So I'm like, okay, so you believe the revenue growth is coming. And if it doesn't come, that's an issue, but it's coming. It's just a question of when it's going to happen. So I agree. I think it's just hard to get that revenue from those clients, but the fact that they're getting those clients will inevitably lead to the revenue.
So I pitched a quick solution to this on Space last week. I do want to get to Snowflake too, talking to Palantir, but
yeah,
if Palantir adopted a consumption-based model, essentially telling the clients, pay as you go using our AIP platform, I do think an adoption would be way quicker initially of like, we don't have to commit to this large CapEx as an org. We can pay as we go and see the use cases as we go. I do think the adoption will come way quicker. The 25% CAGR that everyone's been hoping for Palantir would actually become more of a reality next year. What's your take on, would they want to make that pivot towards a consumption-based model versus what essentially right now is a like licensing model, but not really, but kind of is?
So you're right. They already have a consumption-based model. It's called Data Mesh, and they introduced this back in June of 2023, but it's not been scaled. So it's not like every single client is kind of like a snowflake where you pay as you go. Yeah, I think it's a great idea. I think it's a question of how do they take the initial software they've been selling, given they've projected their revenues to be XYZ based on how they traditionally sell software, and pivot a majority of that to pay as you go, which might actually increase the CAGR. I think it's a difficult thing to do. And I think maybe that's a 3-4 quarter away solution before that scales. But I'm on board with you. I mean, if people could just pay as they go, and they did release a product for developers the other day where anyone can sign up, put in their credit card, and like get access to Foundry. And I know people that are paying a couple $100 a month, which is very similar to Snowflake AWS. Yeah. If that scales, then maybe, you know, you've got a different clientele base that can also increase top line revenue.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you about, first off, you have the ears for the C-suite at Palantir. So it's totally up to you to whisper in their ears the next time you see them, consumption-based model. So Snowflake, I want to bring up, cause I'm overweight on Palantir and Snowflake. They're top five positions for me, both names. However, they're completely different kind of businesses within AI and data. Yeah. But all on Fintuit, it's a complete sibling rivalry of you love Snowflake and you hate Palantir. You love Palantir, you hate Snowflake. There's totally room for both names to thrive because they're in specific niches of their own data and AI. Why do you think that is? Is it because Snowflake was this IPO darling and Palantir always had this chip on their shoulder right from the get-go, proving everyone wrong, where Snowflake had the luxury of like, you're the golden child and you deserve it, and we're just going to ride that wave? Do you think that's the case, or is it something else?
1,000%. I think that when Snowflake went public, they had the blessings of Warren Buffett and all these people. Warren Buffett doesn't know software, right? Why is he into this? He knows there's a quick trade. He knows that it's pumped up. He knows that Wall Street's going to give him liquidity. And so he got into it. And I think with Palantir, the DPO pissed off a lot of Wall Street, and then retail carried them from $6 to $25, right? Like, we had to be the ones convincing the world, no, this is a real thing. Whereas Snowflake never had to do that because they had that institutional investor base. In terms of the rivalry, I think that's one of the reasons. But also, I think one of the problems people have with Snowflake as an AI play is that they see Snowflake as an inorganic form of trying to capitalize on AI. So Snowflake just announced yesterday, or they didn't announce, but some rumors came out that they're trying to acquire Reka AI, which is like their fourth acquisition in 12 months. And so a lot of people are thinking, and the Databricks CEO was a bit more violent with his words, saying Snowflake doesn't know what the hell they're doing with AI. A lot of people are thinking, okay, is this just a data lakehouse that is like commoditized technology from 2012, or are these guys actually developing AI? And I think that's the question. And so many people believe Palantir is real AI, whether it is or whether it isn't is up to someone who's analyzing the company, and they think Snowflake's not real AI. I don't think that's necessarily correct. And I think that creates the rivalry along with the whole Wall Street DPO IPO stuff.
So I created this analogy that I try to explain this to people so often because they don't know the difference between two companies. Mm-hmm. And as you know, like, you can get really in the weeds with the technical terms that you lose people. So essentially I call Palantir, like, let's just say we're a movie studio and we're launching a movie. Palantir is the director of the movie, essentially overseeing the whole production. And Snowflake is kind of the digital media library of showing you all the grunt work in the background of making the movie work.
Yeah.
Is that how you would compare like both names into like some kind of analogy? Because I'm trying to Or do you have a better one? Because I'm trying to get as clean a version of an analogy as possible, because I get this asked every week and it's still not sticking with people as much as I would hope, because they are such different companies. It's not like an AMD, NVIDIA situation. They're like totally different.
I agree. And I think that analogy makes sense. The one part that I get confused about, and maybe you can help me on this as well, the way I think about Palantir's AIP is connecting large language models to business intelligence and to the ontology of an organization. So AI infrastructure. Snowflake, I am still confused. What are they trying to do here? Because they just announced Arctic, which is their new large language model. And I think a lot of people are like, okay, well, LLMs we know are commoditized. We know there's not real value there. So then what is your sort of data integration play in regards to connecting enterprises with the right data? Now, I agree with you that they're the backbone for most enterprises' data. I mean, I think they have like 9,000 clients or something. So like they are there. But the AI multiple, which it's already at 55 billion, right? How do you get it to 100, 200, 300 billion? I think that's what people are struggling with from that perspective.
So Snowflake, really, like, they weren't an AI company as much as you'd think a year ago. So they are essentially were a data warehouse with AI components. I do think like they acquired Search Engine a year ago. And like you just said, the LLM Reka. If you guys don't know Reka, it's OpenAI, Anthropic, and Llama, and then Reka. Reka's fourth, but it's a clear fourth. Like the top three, that's a tier one. Reka's number two. So they're clearly trying to, they have a third of the Fortune 500 data in Snowflake's ecosystem. So they want to create these AI search engine LLMs combining with that data source. Because again, like you guys have heard me talk about this, data is the fuel, gasoline that fuels AI. So if essentially a third of the world's data is in Snowflake's ecosystem, acquire these kind of tools to maximize it for their clients. Luckily, Palantir doesn't have that issue because they're the only pure profitable AI play in the whole world. And they've been around for a long, long time. Like if the government uses you, the US government uses you, that's the biggest validation stamp approval you can ever get. They've been using Palantir for over a decade. So I do think Snowflake is a completely different story, but hopefully that explains it better. But I guess we should also, I do want to question about your vision of Palantir. So inflection point was 6 months ago, in my opinion. They've been a 20% grower for like years, like even back in 2022, but their margin expansion story is something super impressive.
Yeah.
Do you see this as being a consistent 20% grower for like 5 or 6 years? And, or is there like, what's the next inflection point? Is it more, they have to start scaling with their clients? Like if once they get a certain level, that's when you start seeing a take up in the upper line, which then result in 35% free cash flow margins, which, if that combination of 25% top line growth, 35% free cash flow margins, that combo, that's a Rule 40 score of 60. There's only one company in the world who does that right now. That's CrowdStrike. And you've seen the run this on and the premium deserve. So what's your inflection point? Where we'll get to that point of 25% top and 30% bottom, 35% bottom?
I think it's really interesting. I think there's two things that could happen that we haven't seen yet that I think are likely going to happen in my bull case. Number one is Palantir is a central operating system for many governments across the world. People don't know that the entire UK's NHS system is now won by Palantir,
which is huge. It's massive.
It's a massive deal, and they have to fight a lot of politics and bureaucracy to get that deal. And the UK public, I was speaking to someone from Palantir who works at Palantir in the UK. Still, to this day, she gets like cursed out on the street because they know she works at Palantir. Like the UK public did not want them to win for whatever dogmatic reasons they had. Palantir still won. And I think it goes to show you that the government realized that there is no one that could do what they needed to do to power the NHS. You don't see a lot of companies winning deals like that. So I'm like, okay, a socialized healthcare system that cares about the philosophical values of making sure people don't have to pay for basic coverage is going to be inefficient just by the nature of understanding capitalism versus socialism. So Palantir, the technology is there to be the savior. They've got the same problem in Brazil, in Canada, in Sweden, in Germany. So just from a healthcare perspective, Palantir powers 20% of hospital beds in the United States. I could imagine them powering the entire world's healthcare modern infrastructure over the next decade, which I don't know what that means for its government growth. Then we talk about NATO countries. We have a lot of revenue coming from the United States. That's the majority of the U.S. government revenue. The U.S. government's about to spend a shit ton of money. If you have to edit that out, I'm sorry. I've got to curse that. A lot of money on AI and machine learning. It's called JADC2 for the people that don't know what that is. That's going to be, you know, tens of billions of dollars on AI. Palantir just won a contract against Raytheon. It's a hardware contract they won as a software company, making them the United States' first software prime contractor. So when I think about it from that perspective, I'm like, forget commercial just for a bit. The international government growth could be substantial. And then you've got the U.S. Paying Palantir just based on the investments they're doing in AI and machine learning, which could be substantial as well. We're talking about billions of dollars that might happen. My camera just died. Every single day, right? Something's got, all right. So how do I switch my camera? Right, video settings. Okay, I'm going to switch it right here. Boom, we're back. So they're going to get so they could get money from the international revenue in government and then the actual United States government. And so that's all the government revenue that I think could lead them to that 25%, 30% CAGR that we're looking at. And that could happen in the blink of an eye, given how the government starts to spend. The second thing is boot camps. And so, you know, this Palantir basically innovated a new way in terms of their go-to-market. They sucked at sales two years ago. Now they've done over 900 boot camps where they literally go to all these different states and countries. They have 10, 15 clients in a room. They connect operational workflows to real data from the company, show them modules that they can use, and then 6 months later, potentially sign them onto contracts, not by showing them a pitch deck or a PowerPoint, but by literally showing them what the software can do. I think if the boot camp scale, they did 900 in the past 18 months, if they could do 2,500 over the next 18 months, and then the government growth scales, I think both of those could legitimately make Palantir on the path to becoming a Salesforce Oracle type of market cap over the next couple of years, just given the growth is going to be great. And then the adjusted operating margins went from 18% 18 months ago to 36%. It went up 2% last quarter. And so I think that's where, you know, the margin expansion can help the valuation as well.
So I also have this devil's advocate theory on Palantir. If they get to 250 market cap, they're going to get to 2 trillion way quicker, because that's the validation of it. At a certain point, once it scales, it's going to be full turbo speed.
Yes.
Do you think there's going to be a ceiling, though, on their scalability because of how powerful they can actually become one company for the whole world?
It's an interesting question. I think conventional wisdom would suggest that the forces that be might try to stop Palantir from getting that big. Mm-hmm. But I think when you get to, 250, 300 billion and you're that important, like one of the best things about Palantir that gave me assurance in my mind when it was at $6 is I was like, all right, well, the US government's not going to stop using it. So this thing's,
very high floor. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, how do you go bankrupt when your software is powering the entire United States government? So it's like, I think if they get to that point and Karp and Thiel are still the heads of the company, which is a big part of my thesis. If Karp left tomorrow, I might sell my entire business. I mean, like, he is one of the main reasons. I forgot to mention that. That was another reason I got into Palantir, is like this eccentric guy with crazy hair. I've got crazy hair under this hat. Like, I kind of related to him. So I think if Karp and Thiel get to the point where the company is worth $500 billion, you don't bet against Karp and Thiel. Thiel has the most political connections on the planet. Karp is shaking hands with every European prime minister in the world. I think if they get that big, there's no stopping them at that point, and it's going to be a big story.
Yeah, I mean, there's not many companies that are under 50 bill that we can say without a doubt, we can easily see being a multi-trillion dollar company. Yeah. Very few out there. Palantir is one of them. Let's switch industries though, fintech. This is a polarizing industry for me because I thought I had an edge in this industry 2 years ago. Clearly, I did not. I under-anticipated the competitive edge that all these fintech players have with one another. It's highly competitive, low margins.
Yep.
I have a hard time seeing a moat with like specific companies. I know Robinhood specifically, that was the easiest moat because of the UI. You can't duplicate that UI. Yeah. So that was an easy story there. But at the end of the day, brokerage models are not as sticky as people. Like, it's not as sticky as people think, and it's very cyclical, and it's not the best scalable business model. So like, what made you so bullish on fintechs? I know that, correct me if I'm wrong, but you're investing SoFi and Robinhood. So like, I think you are infused within this fintech industry. So what made you want to get into that, knowing these kind of hurdles that I just called out?
So it's really interesting. Initially, I got into fintech by getting excited about SoFi. And the reason I got excited about SoFi was not because they were a bank or a lending company, or, you know, they had a unique interface for people for consumers to use their product over Bank of America. But they were pitched to me as the AWS of fintech, meaning they provided the backend infrastructure for payments APIs for big banks to be able to use their software. Like every time someone uses Robinhood, they're technically paying SoFi to an extent because they power a lot of the backend infrastructure. So I was like, okay, that's kind of like every time you watch Netflix or listen to Spotify, Amazon gets paid because of AWS. So there's like a moat there that's hard to replicate. as I got into SoFi about a year ago, I stopped getting excited about them because the fintech part of the business, the actual tech part that would justify a multiple above, you know, a 1.5 price to book, which is what banks historically trade at, was just not growing, or it was non-existent, or maybe it was growing, but I couldn't see it. I couldn't understand it. Management wasn't really talking about it on the calls. And so I kind of got disinterested in SoFi, and I found a company trading at cash at $7, which was Robinhood. And I've been using the platform for 5 years. And I asked myself, okay, so I use this app every day. So the Peter Lynch part of it made sense. Like, I should probably invest in what I use. Second of all, it's trading at cash. That's an attractive valuation. So the third question is there a moat? And I had this debate for a couple of months before I finally invested, which is UI user experience a moat? And a lot of people that were into SoFi told me at the time, this is a brokerage. It's not a moat. It can be copied. There's nothing sticky about it. And then I had to make an asymmetric bet with myself. And I was like, no, I think you guys are wrong. You can probably copy a brokerage, but you can't copy the product experience that Robinhood has created. And that's when I invested. That investment has turned out well because in the beginning of this year, 2024, obviously the company was undervalued when it was trading at cash. So yeah, I got a little multiple above that. But I did not expect them to announce the flurry of products they announced, which strengthened the ecosystem, made the UI and user interface not only sticky, but like enjoyable to use at a different level in terms of what they've been able to do with retirement accounts and things of that nature. And they diversified the business. Robinhood really goes with the market. If the market goes up, Robinhood has momentum. If it goes down, Robinhood sucks because people stop trading. But they built a couple parts of their business in terms of gold subscriptions, which is their $5 per month SaaS business, and retirement accounts that are independent of the market. And all this happened within the past couple months while the market has started to rally, while crypto has started to go up. And that's what made me realize Robinhood is not just a fintech. It's a financial technology company that actually is B2C in the way that keeps people engaged so deeply that they want to keep using it. And I don't see any other fintech. I don't see a Affirm or SoFi or PayPal have that type of a user experience, which is where the moat came for Robinhood for me.
Yeah, I mean, I put them in the same category as Airbnb for experiences. Like, you make them come back. And every day, like, that's the game changer. And Robinhood had that. I do, like, tilt my hat to, like, their corporate strategy folks, because, again, I've been in it for a decade. And what they did to expand their target demo to make an older with that Roth IRA or retirement match, genius. Capitalize that with the gold card to get the youth, like, excited for, like, the flex, the soft flex at dinner. Like, you flip that out, it's like just as good as a Rolex now.
I can have it. You want to see it real quick?
You got it? Yeah. Jeez.
So this isn't the real card. This is one that Vlad gave to me. It was a prototype.
That's even better.
After I did the podcast with him, but it's a little stained and stuff. But it is like, I think it's a 36 grams or ounces.
Oh, dude, it's thick.
It's thick. Damn. And it's like me.
So it doesn't work yet.
Work at all. This is one of the first prototypes they built in New York. I didn't sign up for the gold card, so I don't know if I'll ever get like a functioning gold card. I will get the regular gold credit card, but this is the one that's like legit made of gold. But it's one of the prototypes that I'll never sell. It'll just be like a reminder of.
But they're going the Tesla route of like making a marketing of like, wow, look at this nice thing. And end of the day, there's thousands of credit cards out there. However, they're
marketing.
It's marketing. It's genius. Yeah. Again, experience. Going on SoFi, let's beat a dead horse a bit. Yeah. Now, I was getting a little excited with SoFi. I think it was 2 years ago. Like I forgot the name of the company is the tech behind the infrastructure, the AWS. Like that was the original. Do you remember the name?
Yeah, Galileo and Technique.
Boom. I was like, damn, this is incredible. Like if this combined with like the social element of like Gen Z and millennials, like being part of their bank, like that's a great combo. It just, what the management was communicating was not reflecting the stock price and like the actual fundamentals. Like, why do you think they didn't really take off like the Robinhood took off clearly as their inflection point? Like SoFi's inflection point should have been they were just thriving even when student loans weren't happening. And there used to be a student loan company, but clearly nobody cares about them thriving, even though their moat was student loans and that's non-existent. So when that comes back, this can be like a massive company revenue wise, but nobody seems to care. Is it because they're starting to realize they're more just a bank and a lot of people don't want to own bank stocks and the tech element is just a little fugate. It's just a little smoke to distract them from end of the day, it's just a bank stock.
I feel like that's what's happening. Palantir, when they released AIP, they did three conferences on the event. Robinhood, their first ever conference for this marketing card, goes like exceptionally well. Where is SoFi's conference? Where is their like big event where they're showing off either their new app or their, you know, their B2B tech? And like the marketing behind what they're trying to sell to the, to Wall Street has been non-existent. The fintech part of the business is not growing, or if it's growing, it's not obvious. So like when I say Palantir did an AIP conference, we can see that they're working with Cisco and Archer Aviation, and we can like see presentations. We don't know who the hell SoFi's clients are. Are they working with JP Morgan, Citibank? Like, are they not allowed to say? Because if they're not allowed to say, how are you going to market these clients? And so if the numbers aren't reflecting it, the marketing isn't reflecting it. And then the app, unfortunately, the app is just not good.
It's garbage.
Yeah.
Jeez. Talk about the opposite UI experience. That's Robinhood.
And I remember, you know, a couple of years ago, I was saying like, hey, if the app sucks, why would people use it? I've tried to build consumer products before, and I understand how difficult it is to get someone to come back every day. That's why, you know, Elon with Twitter, 44 billion, people said he overpaid. I'm like, look, maybe he overpaid, but where else are you going to get real-time information by 500 million people at scale? It's not going to happen on Threads. You know, it's like, it's going to, the network effects are built. And until you build a product that has network effects, which I don't think, SoFi doesn't even have level one options yet in the product. So I'm just like, okay, so your users are not going to be engaging with the app. Your deposits are not increasing because people don't want to put more money to the app. I know a lot of SoFi people that are using Robinhood for all their trading, you know? it's like the direct deposits are not growing that dramatically. What are we excited about? This is a bank that's trading actually at $4 tangible book value. It's at $7, right? So you're paying a little bit of a premium, yeah. And then the tech multiple is not there. So I still think SoFi can do well. I think it's heavily shorted. There's a big retail community. A lot of people will buy the stock if it goes on a run. But I think the institutional investors are not getting excited because they don't really see the moat there.
So for what would change your mind on that their inflection point? Would it be they would just redesign their whole app, or they start cleaning out some of their C-suite and like reorganizing towards like the Robinhood model of like, you know, it's a clear marketing change, clear communication with investors of like what's actually happening, more them opening the door for like everyone to see what they're seeing. Like, what are you monitoring anything for their inflection point? Or is this kind of like they're in the penalty box? I have Robinhood. I don't want to really get too greedy in this space. So I chose my horse. I'm not going to ride two different horses.
Yes, for me, but I bought my sister some options on SoFi back when it was $4. And she doubled her money. I took out her initial capital. So her capital, she all of her money's good. So she's not going to lose money on this. Now she's playing with the house's money. If SoFi gets to $12, she's going to make 30 grand because we got those options really cheap. Right now she's at like 8 grand. So the reason I'm really paying attention to SoFi is because I'm like, hey, if this stupid freaking stock can get to $12, I get to give my sister 30 grand, which is awesome because like she deserves, you know, to get a big win in the market. And so that's what I'm really looking at it in terms of the inflection point. You know, one thing I've been saying is that I feel like Anthony Noto, who's a rockstar CEO, is undermining his retail investing community. I mean, you look at someone like Vlad, who's done two interviews with me, a guy in, you know, in his room with fake brick walls, and they're real bricks. Don't tell anyone I said they were fake, but you know, he's talking to me after their earnings. Anthony Noto has to go on Jim Cramer's show to explain their convertible debt offering. Why don't you talk to the 10 different SoFi YouTubers that exist that actually have retail's attention and tell them what's going on? And I get you don't want to talk to retail when the stock's in the gutter. It looks bad. But if Ryan Cohen from GameStop did that, yeah, that would be a red flag. Anthony Noto's running a real company. He's not just talking to retail to pump his stock. He's talking to retail to actually engage with his shareholders. His shareholders are the ones that own the damn stock. And so to me, the inflection point would be a change in management's tone in relationship to their shareholders and then being more public about this B2B business that's just not growing as aggressively as we thought it was. They've already guided for 2026. And if you look at the numbers, you could argue SoFi doesn't deserve that big of a premium yet. So if they beat on the guidance, which I think they will, maybe the premium comes. But I think they do have to change how management talks to shareholders. Also, I don't think they can replicate the Robinhood experience. It's just, it's not going to happen. So
nobody has done, everyone's tried, nobody's done it. So it's a clear mo. And there's also, it's highly competitive. What SoFi is trying to tackle, like there's so many different companies similar, Bo. What's the wild thing is there's always rumors of, I think 2 or 3 years ago, SoFi would acquire Robinhood. The valuation made sense enough. But now SoFi is worth like $7 or $8 billion and Robinhood's like $16 billion. Tables have turned. Yeah. Do you think a merger of those two companies makes sense still? Because they do target the same demos. And
the problem is SoFi is a bank. Robinhood's not a bank. And so when SoFi got the banking charter, everyone was like, oh, it's so amazing, SoFi's a bank. In my head, Robinhood is my bank. I get 5% APY. My brokerage becomes my pseudo bank. They don't give me a loan or anything, but I can put all my money in my brokerage, get way more than I'm getting at Chase or Bank of America. And it does everything a bank does, which is just store your money at the end of the day, with none of the risk. So if SoFi and Robinhood combined, Robinhood would be joining this conglomerate that is dealing with, I mean, the reason SoFi can't even allow crypto on their app is because they're a bank and the regulators shut that down. Good point. Robinhood at least has, you know, the crypto catalyst behind it as well. So I would hate a merger between them. I think they're also different businesses. I tweeted today that I was watching an interview with Vlad a couple of days ago, and he said on the team, they have employed artists. And the point he was trying to make is that the people they employ, they think of product and UI and UX in an artistic way, and that fuels every second of how they design a user's engagement with the app. I don't think SoFi has any of those people, and I don't think they care about those types of people working at the company, really building a product from the ground up. So I don't think the cultures would fit. I think the banking charter is a risk for Robinhood, and Robinhood gets to do everything SoFi wants to do without having the risk of being a bank.
So I forgot to look into Robinhood's earnings about this, but Coinbase's earnings, I noticed a pretty big dip on the retail crypto volume. Like, they made it up on the institutional crypto volume, like a ton.
Yep.
But they missed on the retail. Did the retail go to Robinhood? Is that what happened? Or it did? So there's a big uptick on the crypto volume from in Robinhood.
So here's the math. Crypto did Coinbase did $56 billion of consumer retail crypto notional trading volumes. Robinhood did $36 billion. So Robinhood did 64% of Coinbase's trading volumes, and Coinbase is global. Robinhood is the majority of the United States. It's a little bit in Europe, but it's majority United States. So one country which is the country that has the most propensity to buy this stuff, does an entire world. The crazier stat is that April or March, when Bitcoin went to 75,000, which is when the money really is made for these brokerages, Robinhood does $23 billion of trading volumes in 1 month, which is 41% of what Coinbase did in 90 days. And so to me, I'm like, well, why is there a shift? And the only reason is because no one cares about this hard wallets, cold wallet crap that Coinbase promotes. The reason is Coinbase has insane fees, lightning fees, network fees. They charge me a fee to transfer my Solana to my bank. Like, literally just take it. They charge $20. I'm like, this is stupid. Robinhood has a flat 0.35% spread. That's really cheap. And I think a lot of people are like, all right, I'm gonna save my money and buy my crypto there.
The biggest bear argument for me for Robinhood, everyone can see my portfolio balance, like on my Twitter, I posted. It's a lot more than the average volume on Robinhood, but I still use Robinhood because I love the UI experience. Like, when
is that where most of your, is all your money on Robinhood or is on Schwab?
No, 40%. I'm so tempted with the match they have of doing everything, but like, that's a perfect example. At the end of the day, I still remember GameStop, that experience. And putting all my eggs in one basket and you're at Robinhood, I don't feel as comfortable. I'm sure it'll go away with time, but that's just the issue they experience. But for Robinhood's only bear argument is their option chain. I think if you're an option trader, they don't go on Robinhood because the spread's too big. You actually lose a decent amount of percentage per transaction. And is that something that, do you know if they're trying to work on, like try to make like their option chain like more competitive, so that the volume can be on options as well with like the other platforms? You know, Thinkorswim is like the most popular one. I forgot what the other one is as well, where like the ones who do large volume every single day, they go on theirs, those brokerages. But Robinhood, they know it's like, that's not gummy options, but like it's sucker options where like a lot of people lose more than they actually think per transaction.
So, you know, it's interesting. Options, I agree. The spread may not be amazing, but I haven't seen that as an issue because Robinhood last month just did 126 million options, volumes of options traded, which was their highest month ever as a public company. So they average about 110 to 115 million option contracts traded. And then the revenue they make from that every quarter is about 154 million. Every single month since they've been public, and last month they just had the highest month because last month was a good month, or April and March have been good months. So yes, I agree. The spread is not phenomenal. For the majority of traders that like don't need the literal pennies of sophistication you get on a more mature platform to do option trading, which like the most sophisticated, that every penny matters. Mm-hmm. I guess for the majority of people, you're buying puts, you're buying calls, you're selling puts, and you're collecting premium. Robinhood does really well. I do a podcast with my friend named TJ. He runs like $5.5 million of just wheeling options. So all he does is options on Robinhood. And when we bring up his portfolio during our podcast, he shows people how to sell options, covered calls, all that stuff. And it's a really good UI. Maybe he's not getting the every last dollar he wants, but he's doing it on Robinhood. And I think there's a lot of people like him and the numbers are showing it. So to me, it's working well, at least for Robinhood right now.
That just proves how valuable experience is, because they're willing to lose like some, they're losing their actual money just to be part of that experience, which is essentially the moat. So is, do you, in your everyday basis going forward, like in the past, do you do research on other stocks, or is it more like, you know, your bread and butter and this is what it is, and you'll dip your toes in on certain names that you find interesting, but don't really go the full nine, like full 100 yards. What's your process on finding new stocks? Like, do you like look at, do you have a tracker or like a watch list already, or do you own a lot more stocks than I know? Because I know you as like the SoFi, Robinhood, and Palantir, but maybe there's a lot more names that I should be on the radar for.
So right now my portfolio is concentrated to two names, Palantir and Robinhood. And the reason for that is because I am trying to solidify for a bit, at least for this year and a half, and then diversify and take some big bets in that respect. And kind of the Warren Buffett, you know, you put your eggs in one basket, watch the hell out of that basket and see if you can, you know, then take your eggs out and grow them in different ways. I have traded through a bunch of stocks. I mean, I had SoFi in the past. I made some money on TFC, which is a regional bank I got really interested in. Google, I've traded in the past. I think my process for investing, so to answer your question, yes, I look at a lot of stocks. I run a market open show every day, so I need to know a lot about different stocks that are going on, different suggestions for the community. Just like that's the bread and butter of how you create content. But in terms of really investing in one, it's after I become so obsessed with the thesis from a numerical perspective and from a qualitative perspective. Like if I were to invest in a Palo Alto Networks when it dropped to 275 and Nancy gave us the nod, I would have had to really believe and understand what the hell cybersecurity is going to be over the next decade. And I just wasn't willing to go that deep into it. So I didn't make the investment, even though I think at 275, it was fairly cheap given the earnings they had. So for me, I look at a lot of stocks. I think over the next couple of years, I'll be diving deeper into individual stocks and kind of constructing a portfolio like that. I'm getting much more deeper into the option selling game, which is finding stocks and then wheeling them with cash curve puts and covered calls. And for that game, you got to know like 3 to 5 names really well and then rinse and repeat. So that's kind of been the philosophy right now. But I pay attention a lot to the macro because I'm interested in things that are going on. Like I can tell you Reddit's numbers from their last earnings, even if I don't have it, just to be able to talk more about different stocks.
So what industry gets you really excited though? Like going for, like, that you like know in 2 or 3 years, like once you get solidified this period, like you want exposure in this industry.
You know, I'll give you an interesting one. I think digital advertising is not going anywhere and it's getting better and better and better. The Metas of the world, the Trade Desks of the world, like it seems very obvious our attention. You know, it's so funny as well. I've been using Meta since I was like, you know, 12 years old. And in college, I was making some money. I had a side job and I could have been throwing a couple $100 every month into Meta, but I just didn't know the stock market existed. But if I did, I would be like, of course I would invest in Facebook. I'm using Instagram every single day. And so I think the network effects on big tech are so substantial that digital advertising is where the attention is going to be. Obviously, I could say AI and that's a big sector and you know everyone's excited about that. But in particular, I think if you want to advertise something on this planet and you have a limited budget, Facebook, Google are the only places you can really go. And then Trade Desk powers a lot of that. And then you've got your Pinterest, your Reddits of the world. But I think those are the big winners. So digital advertising to me is going to get really exciting over the next year, especially with the election coming up. And Meta is probably the winner there.
Not just, again, I think linear TV is absolutely dead in the waters. You're clearly seeing all these CTV packages from all the streamers combined in one. Like that's, even if they all combine and it feels like cable, it won't be on cable. It's going to be on CTV. So I'm fully on your team where like ad tech is a very exciting exposure for the next like 5 or 7 years. Is there anything you want to say to the listeners? Like want to communicate where they can see all your morning sessions? Because I didn't know you did every single morning and you did comment that it's getting pretty big. So maybe I need to check it out because I'm pretty dead in the mornings. Like I don't, there's nothing I'm watching really.
We would love to have you as a contributor a couple times in the morning. Just join in, you know, 5, 6 minutes, give us your thoughts. No, I would love to. But for you, it's like 5 a.m. So you probably
I'm up at 3:30. You have to. In this game, you got it on the West Coast. You got 2 hours of like actual work before the market opens.
Would you ever move to the East Coast to keep up with the markets?
Oh, I've moved to Europe instantly. My fiance is not done with LA yet. So like she's only 20, she's 25, so like she's just still living that. So I'm waiting for her green light for us to get out of this city. I've grown up here my whole life, so it's Dude, it's a grind. I think, have you ever been to West Coast for like a couple weeks during the trading hours?
Yes.
It's brutal.
Yeah.
It's absolutely brutal.
Yeah. I'm going to be in California in June as well. And I'm going to have to still do my show, and I'm going to have to be up early. It's definitely brutal. And for me, I've been waking up, you know, early every single day for the past 2 years now and doing the show. And it's 8:45 a.m. every morning. And the reason the show is super exciting is because, like, I get to get up and give my thoughts and opinions to the world about what I'm thinking in the markets. And it's cool. It's the reason you do content creation in the first place, so that people might care a little bit about your thoughts and opinions. But the only way it works is if you care more about them and the value you can provide to them more than you care about yourself. So yeah, it's super exciting. I would love to have you on the show at some time. People can find it on my YouTube channel. I'm sure you guys will link it here. And yeah, it's super cool. It's a fun, energetic way from a 26-year-old who's not the smartest guy in the world, but is willing to learn. And one of the things I didn't mention is I did debate in high school, and I ended up, you know, winning a few championships.
I was going to say, you're really articulate and you talk really like elegant. Like, you talk, someone who literally can't speak English, obviously. you did a really good job. So I'm not surprised that you're on a debate team in high school. Did you place?
Yeah, I ended up being the seventh best debater in the country in 2016.
What?
Yeah, it was a cool journey. And I was one of nine people on the national USA debate team. So, like, represented the country in international debate. And I was the third best public speaker in Europe. So
it was, why did you want to be a politician?
Well, so, you know, it's funny with debate skills. The only three things you can do is like a lawyer, a politician, or build a brand, right? Because you need communication to build a brand. And so I never was interested in being a lawyer. The politician thing, I don't think politicians really make that much of a difference. I think entrepreneurs make more of a difference. So I went the personal branding route, and it's been working well. So I take those communication skills I did in debate, or I learned from debate, and I apply them to the stock market. And then I take my humor. I've always wanted to like be the next, Andrew Scholes, Dave Chappelle. I'm not that funny as I think I could be. So literally, like, I've had a dream of one day selling out Madison Square Garden. And I know it's a crazy dream, right? But just having 20,000 people while I'm talking is amazing. I don't know if I'm ever going to get to do that. But on YouTube every morning, I get a glimpse of what that feels like, even though I'm not there in person. And so that, just as soon as you wake up, you know, even if you're a little tired, as soon as I press go live, it's like you're there. This is the opportunity. You're alive. You're on planet Earth. One day you're going to die. Take advantage of this moment and hopefully make some money along the way talking about stocks.
So, well, you got some taste with Vlad. I mean, I'm sure that all spotlight around, like, oh, I can get used to this a bit. Well, thank you for hopping on. Hopefully we can get you on the guest again, like in a couple months for sure. See where SoFi, if SoFi can get over the $10, or if Palantir can finally break through 30. We'll see. Thank you again for hopping on. See you.